This is
Make It Kind.
M.I.P.
with Masamela Matfumo.
Mark Thompson.
Make It Kind.
Get woke.
New from Radiotopia presents Red for Revolution, an audio drama about Black love, queer romance, and liberation. Join Jasmine, an 18-year-old navigating her queer identity while learning about her grandmother's secret love affair. Through her discoveries, we're transported back to 1971 to witness two remarkable women embark on a romance that defies all conventions. Subscribe to Radiotopia Presents and listen to Red for Revolution wherever you get your podcasts.
Different morning, please. January 19th, 2026. Happy Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Always proud to say that because we know the struggle we went through to make this day a national holiday. We not only lift up Dr. King today, but we lift up Dr. Coretta Scott King as well, who made all the difference in the world in fighting for that holiday, Stevie Wonder as well. And I always say to people, if you ever, you can Google it, look at the picture. Ronald Reagan didn't want to sign the bill, but when you see him sitting at the presidential desk signing the King holiday bill, and Mrs. King looking over his shoulder, that is the manifestation of thou preparest a table before me in the presence of thine enemies. Amen. So God bless Mrs. King as well and the King family and what this day means. It means so much to all of us this historic day. Folks, we're going to continue with the conversation that our program director, Katia Stitt, initiated all day long, or this morning, I should rather, 9 in New programming on WPFW and was streaming live on social media on the Pan-Africanist Dr. King. We always focus, well, not we, but those who would define how we define Dr. King always want to focus on one speech on one day. But there's so much more. And there was a Pan-Africanist Dr. King. There is, as his ancestry lives on and should live on through us, we should act obviously in that regard. And so we want to talk about the Pan-Africanist Dr. King this morning. And there's a new book out entitled Beyond Borders, Martin Luther King Jr., Africa, and Pan-Africanism. To my knowledge, there have been articles, it's been touched upon, it's been discussed, but to my knowledge, I'm not aware of any other comprehensive work or volume that delves as deeply and as comprehensively and exhaustively as this one does. And so we're happy to have join us here today, the distinguished professor of international law from FAMU joining us. We're happy to have the author of Beyond Borders, Dr. Jeremy Levitt. Dr. Levitt, God bless you, man. Thank you for joining me. I know you're traveling and just getting back in, so we appreciate you taking the time. First of all, congratulations on the book and happy Martin Luther King Jr. Day.
Well, look, brother, if it wasn't you, I'd be sleeping right now because I'm you know, when you get older, the traveling takes its toll on the body. And I just did a red eye in from Phoenix to Florida, to Orlando. So, but I'm happy to be here with you. When a man gives his word, he keeps his word.
Well, I so appreciate that. And we should note, from what I could tell from the social media posts, your visit to Phoenix was quite successful. Carver Museum, am I right?
The Carver Museum and Cultural Center in Phoenix, Arizona. It's a centennial year, founded in 1926 as a high school for colored people, the only Black center of gravity in Phoenix, a segregated high school. And the alumni got together and they purchased the building. And yeah, this is why we have the museum. And I sit as president of the board there. So, yeah, it's a glorious time.
Yeah. And so glorious, too, because as I said, man, we don't talk about this enough. Am I inaccurate in saying that there's not really been any other published volume like yours, right? I mean, comprehensively.
Yeah, I think that's right. There's a scholar at Vanderbilt named Lewis Baldwin who came out with one related to South Africa And there have been a few articles written on his global tradition, but nobody's writing an article or a book that really looks at him in the context of Africa and Pan-Africanism writ large. So that'd be clear.
Well, no, this is very, very important. So let's not delay in terms of having this conversation. It's important that we begin. This didn't come out of nowhere. And it's always healthy when we can talk about the intergenerational kings. This got going, this affinity and awareness of the African world, as Dr. John Henry Clark used to call it, began with Daddy King, didn't it?
You know what? Yes, I would say, but probably even more so, at least in the origin, it was A.D. Williams, the maternal grandfather, who was the pastor at Ebenezer Baptist Church. And they had a liberation theology agenda at their church. And this is the church that King grew up in. And I think he grew up on a street in Atlanta. It was a well-to-do Negro street called Sweet Auburn. And in fact, Fortune magazine said at one time it was the richest street for Negroes in the country. I don't know if that's true, but certainly it was well-to-do, and it was a epicenter of activity and particularly dialogue on issues. And so that kind of dynamic King had, two-parent, a very strong household, three generations of preachers. And his father was, in his own right, a man of great stature, not just in the community, but, you know, he had traveled into Europe and North Africa. And so King, you know, when you have a father who's been to Libya and Palestine and Tunisia and traveled throughout Europe, and King is getting this information brought home. He came from a very well-educated, well-to-do household that was certainly not just pro-Black, but actively involved with fighting Jim Crow. So this is the beginning of the formation of his mind. In many ways, his African consciousness began at home and within his community. And then with the traumatic experiences that King had, and it's important I say this because early on in King's life, he hated white people, literally. He says it in his books. And certainly, where do we go from here? But it's in his autobiography, because he remembers being slapped by a white woman for stepping on her toe at the age of 6 years old. I think he may have been eight then. At the age of six, his childhood friend Jay, who lived in the community because the father was a shop owner, was told that he couldn't play with King anymore because King was a nigger. And King had a variety of these traumatic racialized experiences in his life. He won a contest when he was in high school. He was 14 years old on the Negro and the Constitution. And he went from Dublin to Atlanta, and he was in that 90-mile ride. He was forced to stand with his teacher and give up their seats to white folks. So he had a real issue. And had it not been for his parents really giving him the ethic of Christian love, King most certainly would have been radicalized in a way where hate was a part of his doctrine. And it wasn't, because he had these surrounding forces that nurtured him in the right way.
Tell us more, if you could, about Daddy King's travel. And wasn't that was kind of extraordinary at that time, early 30s and 40s, to be a Black world traveler, was it not?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, Daddy King was a preacher. He was defiant. There are stories of Daddy King walking out of a store because they made him enter the back and wanted him to sit in the back, and King was with them. And it, rather than do business with it, he walked out of the store. There's a story of a police officer calling Daddy King a boy in front of King, and Daddy King stood up, which he didn't do in the South at the time as a black man. He stood up against them and he said, "You're not going to call me a boy." So there are these interactions that showed a certain level of black dignity at a time when you could be lynched for pushing back. And then at the same time he's doing this domestically, he's in Europe in 1934. And he sees the making of what was going to be a fascist state. It's very interesting because when he comes back from North Africa, the Middle East, and Europe, he says, and I quote, that he had uncovered the mysteries of the Southern racial order as a dehumanizing system. So he had decoded what was happening by going back to the motherland of white folks and seeing their systems, and he knew that the making for World War II was there in what he saw. He could feel it in the air. And so when you look at his father, his grandfather, they come out of a tradition where the motto is this: liberate the oppressed, feed the poor, and welcome the stranger. So if we know about King's paradigm of the three evils of society, it's racism, poverty, and militarism. So when you look at that, you see where this framing came for King so early on, with a father who I think the last thing is surrounded him. His father was a legend in the community. And so people like Mordecai Wild Johnson. Yes, and the rest of the Morehouse and beyond community, these men of great stature formed a part of the inner network that King had access to.
And do we know? So I don't want to do the time. We want to do the timeline. As Daddy King was traveling, how old would MLK Jr. have been?
Well, he was traveling before he was born, and he was traveling, you know, obviously when he was a child. So, you know, King is born. I think Daddy King's trip to Europe was 1934. So this is all in kind of the making of King prior to him going away to Morehouse. Because remember, he went to Morehouse at the age of 15.
Right. That's right. Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So no, that's very, very important. We then found, and I found this intriguing, and I'm glad you included it in the book when I first stumbled upon it. Dr. King wrote a research paper in 1948 entitled "Light on the Old Testament from the Ancient Near East." That gives us an early glimpse, does it not, of his world view?
It does. It does. I mean, he, it's extraordinary because at this time, you know, at the time, probably by the early 1960s, King had amassed a library of over 1,000 volumes on every topic. And when you go through the books, as I have, I wanted to know what he was reading, what he was thinking, what formed his opinions. You know, King was a bona fide Africanist. I mean, he really understood African history well. And so in this paper, you mention "The Light of the Old Testament from the Ancient Near East." And remember, the Ancient Near East is code for Africa, right? It's Africa and parts of the Middle East. This is the Ancient Near East. And what he's really talking about is Kemet, the ancient Egyptian capital city. Instead of it being called Egypt, it was called Kemet, as you know. And this is remarkable because he's reading the works of Fahotep and Akhenaten and studying these, and he's drawing a comparison in this paper between these Kemetic figures, these gods, these otherwise extra-worldly figures, and Psalms. And he's saying that there are striking parallels between this historical ancient Egyptian history and Psalms in the Bible, that the Egyptian texts and the Hebrew Psalms and Proverbs are paralleled, and we know which one came before the other. So what he's saying is that even in his own tradition, he's aware that the origin of the Bible is African in nature. And to write this in 1948 is next to remarkable for a young man to do that. And he was very influenced by this Africanized vision of the world. And and I think it guided him through his life. I mean, you're talking about someone who was deeply religious. So if it wasn't right, if it was what I would call, sometimes we engage in excessive negritude as Black folks because we want to blackify everything. King was a realist, and so it had to meet his metric, his standard, which was very high. And so when I look at it and I read the paper, I said, my God. And this is why I put it in the book, because I said, this gentleman was at a whole different level at this period of time, when Black folks in houses, it was hard to find books, bound books in many households at that time. So it was pretty remarkable.
Hey, football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown in the game, but his teammate scores instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you a second chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown in the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. With BetMGM's second chance offer, you have a chance to keep the fun going after the first player crosses the goal line. Try a first TD score wager with confidence today. BetMGM, make it legendary. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This specific promotional offer is not available in Mississippi, Pennsylvania, Puerto Rico, or Ontario. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 for New York. 1-800-NEXT-STEP for Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 for Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-ALL for Iowa. 1-800-981-0023 for Puerto Rico. Existing customer offer. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards paid back in unrestricted withdrawable funds. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
It's remarkable. And see, part of what, you know, folks, I do this show, I've been doing this for years, I have guests on. Sometimes when I invite a guest, it's obviously for our own edification and knowledge, but it's also to convince myself I'm not crazy. Because when I saw that, right, this is the only person I've heard say this out loud, other than me, that Dr. King was looking at Kemet. Right. So what Dr. Leavitt has just done is done me a personal favor. Let me know I'm not crazy, but he's also opened the door for us to embrace that and have more understanding. And again, Dr. King was taken from us at such a young age. Imagine. Yes. And Dr. Leavitt, you're aware of the advent of African scholarship like Sheikh Anta Diop and Dr. Ben and Dr. Clark. What if Dr. King had lived to interact with those African scholars on Kemet? Woo! I mean, yeah. Would have been, doctor, that would have been a whole nother thing.
Well, so, let me give you a window. Prior to him writing this article, he wrote an article titled Kick Up Dust. And this was written for the local paper at Morehouse University. And he says in this that he's reminding white leaders that the loudest defenders of racial segregation and purity, listen now, produced America's most mixed population. The loudest purveyors of racial purity, the white Southern segregationists who want to be segregated from us, are the greatest defenders and implementers of producing America's mixed population. Meaning that when they say they want to be segregated with us, they didn't mind integrating when they were raping our women and producing children that had mixed blood. That the people who first integrated America were white Americans and their plantation systems. They integrated America. And in fact, if you really look at segregation, and if they would have lived by the law of separate but equal, Black folks wouldn't have minded. We would have been just fine. They have theirs. We have ours. We can run ours. Every Black town we've had, Colfax, Rosewood, Ocoee, they've destroyed it with genocidal types of violence. So they wouldn't leave us alone. They didn't want to integrate with us, but they had already integrated us. biologically and violently through brutal rape. And so it's amazing when you think and you look at this. So this is what he is saying. This is what King is saying. And basically he's saying, and he says it very explicitly. He says, look, white roughs and aristocrats, leave our women alone. You've already done your job on the black woman. This is not the king that you hear. This is not the dreamer and the integrationist who's sending a message in his youth for the white man to leave our women alone. And that you're the reason why we integrated in this country. We never asked for it. You forced it on us. And then you wanted to segregate after you did the damage, like a criminal running away from a crime.
Dr. Jeremy Levitt, folks, Beyond Borders, as we look at Dr. King, Beyond Borders, Martin Luther King Jr., Africa, and Pan-Africanism, the Montgomery movement, he globalized that movement as well, did he not?
So the Montgomery bus boycott movement was organized by the Montgomery Improvement Association. I would say poor, local black people globalized the movement. But they saw that King had leadership qualities. And as he began to work with them, they appointed him the leader of the movement. But the movement had already begun before King was involved. But he became a core strategist. So I say the masses of the people globalized. King was the figurehead. He was the leader. And so it was that movement of poor black folks. And that boycott is not one day. It's not 2 days. It's not 10 days. It's not 100 days. It's not 200 days. It's 381 days of people not going to work saying, we're going to develop our own alternative transportation system while shutting theirs down. Now, when they say black folks can't do things, we can't organize, we're not, you know, going to be innovative. Well, that's a lie, because you just need to study the Montgomery bus boycott and look at what black folks who were living on the poverty line, in fact, did. And that movement, because it was nonviolent, and because they forced a Southern white economic system to bow down, caught the attention of the entire world, including the African leaders that were seeking to decolonize. And that's how King rose to the highest level, because of this system of nonviolent direct action that he implemented that the world paid attention to.
And then, so that was 1955. Dr. King, was his first trip to Ghana, the very first, for the independence celebration, or did he go prior?
No, it was in 1957. At the invitation of Kwame Nkrumah, he went to Ghana, and it transformed him.
How so?
It transformed him because he saw how Kwame Nkrumah and his party were able to negotiate an agreement with Britain to decolonize. That it occurred nonviolently, because remember, there were violent struggles occurring at the same time, and some that would begin after that. And so he was amazed by watching this. He was amazed by watching Africans in Ghana attain their freedom, and sad that the Negro in the most powerful country in the world, the United States, were still living under Jim Crow segregation. So it gave him a new awakening and a new moment. He cried at the independence movement. And there's a African-American that was in Ghana that received him, named Dr. Robert Lee and his wife, Sarah. They were dentists. They were among the first dentists in Ghana. I had an opportunity to interview them years ago and spend time with them. And they kind of became like a surrogate family. And he tells me the story that he received King when King came, and Nkrumah told him to receive him. And King wanted more time with Nkrumah, you see. But Nkrumah was receiving leaders from around the world, and there were several African-Americans on that trip, Langston Hughes, Bayard Rustin, and others were there. They flew together on the trip. So King was upset. He had what the young kids would might call, he had a small crash out there and he got sick. But he was able to recover and really enjoy Ghana and what Ghana had to offer. And when he came back, he was so inspired. I think he gave what might be his best speech, which is Birth of a New Nation, which is about this experience in Ghana and what occurred. So yeah, King was absolutely phenomenal. And Ghana opened up his eyes in ways that one couldn't have imagined before he made the trip.
And after that experience, was there an immediate effort on his part, Dr. Leavitt, to tie the civil rights movement to Africa?
I certainly think that turbocharged it. He was already engaged. I mean, he was already in conversations with Oliver Tambo of the African National Congress. He was already Africanized. And so what this did was open up, because when he was there, he was meeting the African leadership, right? The African leaders that came there from around the world, he was connecting with them in Ghana. And this is why he went to Nigeria in 1960 for the inauguration of Madamwe Zikwe, the first head of state of Nigeria, which is interesting because Nkrumah and Zikwe went to Lincoln University. They were trained by African-Americans here. I think Langston Hughes was a classmate of theirs, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
So the idea that King is moving forward in this direction in a way that is amazing and is responsible for Barack Obama becoming the first Black president of the United States. Ask me what I mean.
What do you mean?
So King worked with Tom Mboya of Kenya, one of the great leaders of the Kenyan revolution and independence. And Mboya and King became close, as he was with Ben Bala, Julius Nyerere, Kenneth Kaunda. And they set up a foundation funded largely by African Americans to bring Africans to the United States to go to school. And that funding, it was King and several other prominent African Americans, Jackie Robinson. There were entertainers, the whole core group that was engaged in the civil rights movement at the time, and that's how Barack Obama's father came to the United States through the funding of the organization set up with King and others and Tom Mboya of Kenya. Isn't that amazing?
It is amazing. Has Barack Obama ever acknowledged Dr. King and Jackie Robinson and others' direct role in that?
I don't know. I've never seen anything, but it doesn't mean that he didn't. And he might not know. He may not know that history is in that deep way. I mean, this is something that you got to kind of be in the archives and bring out. But Barack Obama was brought here through a form of immaculate conception based on the Pan-African conviction of King and other Black Americans.
That's right. Dr. Leavitt showing a little bit of his preaching skill whenever you speak from pulpit and you ask how did he bring Barack Obama here? I'm glad you asked. He said that's called call and response, but we're gonna do homiletics too today. So Oliver Tambo, they were in contact.
Yeah.
And I'm doing that for a reason. I'm going to draw something together. I'm bringing something together. Talk to us about Oliver Tambo and the African National Congress, please, and Dr. King.
Well, I mean, you know, it's an interesting conversation for me because I spent so much time in Africa and I worked for the South Africans during the constitutional making process. I had a chance to meet Mandela and just... And the Tambo family and then the other leaders of the ANC movement. And so this is incredible. When I saw the communications, King was one of the greatest advocates against apartheid in the United States. And he challenged the United States government in this context. Mm-hmm. And he was in written communication with the Tombo family. I think King may have met with the wife, Miss Tombo, in London. I'd have to go back and look, but he was a bulwark anti-apartheid activist. And there is a white preacher named George Hauser who started the American Committee on Africa. And this organization's sole purpose was to lobby against apartheid South Africa, the continuing apartheid of what it was Southwest Africa, which is now Namibia. And that kind of mission expanded, and King was one of the big supporters of this organization. And he took this issue to the United Nations. He went to the United Nations. He was a, you know, his activism on Vietnam, his activism on the anti-apartheid movement. And this is why on the cover of the book, you'll see another gentleman. That other gentleman is Ralph Bunche. And that's a meeting at the United Nations in New York, in Ralph Bunche's office. Ralph Bunche, of course, being the first African-American Nobel Prize laureate, and just a guy who we underestimated in terms of history, in terms of what he actually did. He's the only person to negotiate an armistice agreement between the Arab states and Israel after the Six-Day War. So you have two powerful peacemakers there, two Nobel laureates in that picture. And so he's lobbying Ralph Bunche and everybody to ensure that the United States is not supporting apartheid and trying to galvanize world opinion against the apartheid regime, which he viewed as savages, and his critique of white South Africans is like nothing I've ever seen.
And did he not early on himself, before, you know, the anti-apartheid movement was in its full throes in the 80s, did not Dr. King join Hauser in the call for a global boycott?
Oh yes, he was. I mean, there wouldn't have been a global boycott without the gravitas of King being a part of it. I mean, he spoke vigorously and consistently and comparatively about apartheid in South Africa and Jim Crow. He was a master at weaving in oppression, colonial oppression, and apartheid, which is an outlier in the colonial context in many ways, and Jim Crow segregation, is shining a light on those things. He calls them systems that are a manifestation of a single evil of racial caste. So he was all in, and he continued this advocacy from ACOA, we call it, to ACLA, which is the American Negro Leadership Conference on Africa, where the Black notables got together and developed another organization, this totally controlled, run, governed by Blacks, which was to influence the U.S. government to support African liberation rather than to sabotage it. And in fact, the State Department and the White House tried to sabotage the formation of this organization because they didn't want African Americans being tied to Africa and trying to influence American foreign policy. And of course, they failed in their effort to stop them. And so this is another African organization that King was involved in being a founder of. And so it's remarkable that we don't know these things.
The American Negro Leadership Conference on Africa, what year would that have been?
That would have been in the 1960s.
In the 1960s.
So he's kind of tripling his efforts at supporting African liberation and being a part of the anti-apartheid struggle and opposing neo-colonial and colonial interventions. So this is when this work is really amping up, and then wanting us to, the United States government, to engage in a certain level of policy and development in Africa. While at the same time, from the late 1950s, from 57 on, he was encouraging African Americans to immigrate to Africa and to work with Africa on its development, take our technical skills and be a part of Africa's development. Pretty amazing.
So Martin Luther King was sounding like Marcus Garvey.
No, well, he achieved what Marcus Garvey couldn't achieve for his time. Marcus Garvey never went to Africa. And Marcus Garvey wanted to set up, I think Marcus Garvey had a more romanticized view of Africa in the sense that he wanted to be president of Africa, which is a continent and, of course, not a country, full of nations and empires. And so Marcus Garvey wanted to send people back, and he began that process. There are some that ended up going to Liberia. But King was different. He understood that we needed to go assist the Africans, not dominate them, and to bring our expertise to build a Pan-African a community within Africa, assisting Africa, and there would be a reciprocity that would help Black Americans. Marcus Garvey, his view was slightly different because he started what might be called a Black nationalist perspective, and then that evolved into a core Pan-Africanist agenda, both believing in virtually the same thing. It was just the period of time and what they faced. Garvey was older. He was born in a different generation. He was Jamaican, had a different experience with colonization rather than Jim Crow. But at the end of the day, they had a meeting of the mind, not unlike King and Du Bois, who were almost parallel in their thinking about Africa. In fact, the major difference between those two would have been that Du Bois became a socialist and King was not a socialist. And he was, I think he moved away from his Christian identity, and King was, you know, a hardcore believer in Christ and a pastor. So all of them have this synergy together.
In the moments remaining, Dr. Jeremy Levitt with us, folks, Beyond Borders, Martin Luther King Jr., African Pan-Africanism, part of our theme today on WPFW, MIP on 89.3, up until noon. And then we'll shift the focus to Haiti, Haiti. Dr. Levitt, I want to reconcile a couple of things. Mm. Dr. King, Oliver Tambo, anti-apartheid, and then obviously what he's most known for, because you're informing us of his Pan-Africanism like no one else has before, but we're well informed of his embrace with Gandhi. Is it out of order for me to ask some reconciliation between that embrace of Gandhi, obviously because of his nonviolent approach, and Gandhi's contradiction when it came to South Africa?
Yeah, I mean, I think Gandhi was a trained lawyer. He trained at the University of London, and he went on a trip to South Africa to represent a client, and he stayed 21 years. He used his law degree to organize Indians who were being oppressed by the apartheid system, and to be a core advocate. So this philosophy, Satyagraha, I think is how it's pronounced, of love and peace and nonviolent resistance, was tested in South Africa. So again, Africa birthed Gandhi's paradigm that ended up being inherited by King. It still came out of the experience of the African continent and battling apartheid in South Africa. But what Gandhi did was he was the first one to show how the ethic of love could be embraced in the context of a nonviolent direct action movement to fight white supremacy. So there's this wonderful synergy, because Gandhi's philosophy that he tried and he worked on and developed came out of the South African experience. And then it was inherited by King and other civil rights leaders, Bayard Rustin, Mordecai. The rest of them kind of taught King this philosophy, and so King then flipped it and utilized it in the American South. And so when I talk about the term beloved Pan-Africanism, it comes out of his notion of beloved community, a society, a brotherhood, and a sisterhood of all for the collective goodwill, the utilization of the world's resources for the betterment of man. But beloved Pan-Africanism is different. It's grounded in his philosophy of fighting racism, poverty, and militarism. And there are five pillars, and I want to share those because it's very important. When you distill what King was doing, he never called it beloved Pan-Africanism. I called it that. And this is what happens when people get assassinated, you have to go back and look at their work. There are five pillars: love, global Blackness, radical nonviolent resistance, empathy, brave personal sacrifice, and divine justice. These are the pillars that formed King's version of Pan-Africanism. So when you begin to wrap those around and compare them to other versions, you'll find that his probably has the most endearing philosophy that can galvanize the largest number of Black people around the world.
The five pillars, very important. Folks, we're going to try to get some calls in before we go. 202-588-0893. And Studio, if you don't mind, just put the caller's name and put it in the chat so I can call on them most efficiently. But I guess what I was also saying, early on, Gandhi, it has some racist views toward indigenous African South Africans. I guess that's the reconciliation I'm looking for.
I think that Gandhi had no interest in the plight of Black South Africans and fighting apartheid. And he made that clear.
And so is it okay? Did Dr. King know that? Is it okay to align historically even so much? I mean, we have no choice, but was Dr. King aware of that? And if he were not, might that have influenced his embrace of Gandhi?
I don't know if he was aware of it, and I don't think it would have mattered. And this is why, because Gandhi shut down British India. And what King was, he was a tactician. He would have looked at the effect of the impact of Gandhi as a human rights figure and still utilized it, because Gandhi's system and approach was highly effective. And King was, you know, a subscriber to it at a later time than many other African Americans who were prominent. And he was right. At the end of the day, King was right. I don't think that would have stopped him at all, in the same way that his love for Malcolm X continued despite being called an Uncle Tom at times.
Well, and that's the next reconciliation. If we're talking about the King being a co-founder of the American Negro Leadership Conference on Africa, how many of us knew that? And Malcolm and the Organization of Afro-American Unity, what's the difference? I think that speaks to an inevitability. If they had been allowed to live, there would have been some coming together. Or is that a hypothesis going? Am I being too idealistic, like Marcus Garvey may have been?
So let me go back to Garvey. There's always been a romanticization of the Black diaspora with Africa, and I don't see that as unhealthy. But when you begin political action, it needs to be grounded in some core realities. Garvey was the GOAT. And because he was deported by J. Edgar Hoover, I think J. Edgar Hoover was actually the lawyer on Garvey's case.
That's fact. That was the beginning of his career. Yes.
Yes. So because Garvey was deported, that stopped the movement. They've always targeted these movements and feared him. So I don't think Garvey hit his full potential because the Jamaicans weren't listening to him. He had to come here to the American Negro to get any mobility in terms of his ideology. So he got cut short, and that was the plan by the United States government. With Markham and Malcolm, I think that they had already begun to reconcile. I mean, some of the names some of the language that Malcolm used against King was unfortunate. And I think that turned King off to Malcolm. But when King was locked up, Malcolm made every effort. He even visited Coretta Scott King, I think it was in Montgomery, and threatened the sheriff and basically said they better not harm or hurt this brother. Malcolm was reaching out to King, especially when he had his awakening, and he wanted to work with King. And I think that they would have eventually gotten through whatever those differences were, because at the end of the day, King had a respect for Malcolm. But Malcolm tried to derail the movement that King had advanced by having a competing ideology. And then you had the three-letter institutions of the United States government in there penetrating these organizations, creating more tension between these Black leaders. I think they would have come together. I think really they would have come together within a period of, you know, 2 or 3 years. If they had 2 or 3 more years together, they would have been a formidable brotherhood that America and the world would have had to contend to. And that's exactly why I think they were cut short. Remember that right before King was murdered, assassinated, he was tapped to be the chief negotiator in the Biafran secession conflict in Nigeria. Can you imagine that?
No one knows that. Folks, most of you hearing that for the first time. Let's not even kid ourselves.
Yes.
Repeat that one more time in case people think, you know, the signal dropped or we having some static breaking up. Repeat King, that because I may not believe that, please.
Yes, King was going to be the chief negotiator in the Biafran secession movement. This was a civil war in Nigeria of largely Igbo who wanted to separate. And there was a bloody armed conflict, arguably with crimes against humanity and genocide unfolding. And both sides agreed that King would come in and mediate that dispute. So here again, you have an African-American of great prominence, the peacemaker, coming in to help our brothers in Africa, and he was assassinated. And when you look at who would benefit from a peace agreement and who wouldn't, and you follow the money trail, no one has ever tried to draw a line between his assassination and rare earth minerals and natural resources in Africa and his eventual death. I'm not saying one exists, but I'll say I asked the question.
Well, no, we're scholars. We can ask questions. That's not the same as declaring a conspiracy, y'all. When you ask questions, as Dick Gregory taught us, when you ask a question, that's okay. So nobody can complain about that. One, just to give us a setting and context and time, what year would that have been, Dr. Leavitt?
Well, so this was in the mid to late 1960s. He was assassinated while the war was ongoing in Nigeria.
Right. Yeah. One more reconciliation. We'll get a quick call or two in. I see you, Miss Alberta. Don't go away, but I think you'll love this. There's one more thing. The cover, Ralph Bunche, Beyond Borders, Martin Luther King Jr., African Pan-Africanism, available everywhere right now. Brand new book, y'all. I mean, this is hot off the presses. So you're getting this first, MIP on 89.3. Ralph Bunche. And again, there's been sort of a misreading of Ralph Bunche's history in terms of the settlement he negotiated, and some have begun to reconsider whether there's anything he may have done to enable the Zionism that we see today. One, on that point, is that a fair question about him? And two, wouldn't Ralph Bunche have agreed with Dr. King with regards to the Palestinian question? And please talk to us about that too, because Dr. King was very involved in the Palestinian question too.
Well, I wouldn't say he was very involved, but if King makes a statement, that's very involved, right? Because of his stature. So I wouldn't disagree with that either. So Ralph Bunche, his job, he was a UN official. So his job was to help negotiate peace. That's it. When you're in these situations, I've been in these situations as a peace negotiator, you're trying to bring both sides to the table. No one's going to get everything they want. The Palestinian state was already, the Israeli state was already on its way. The land that had been taken and given to the Jewish community was taken in 1912 via treaty given by Britain. So the borders weren't going to change unless the war would have been won outright. That wasn't going to happen because of massive U.S. support of Israel at the time. So he negotiated with the best formula he could to stop the war. And that's the job of a peace negotiator. It's not to do it under a politicized context. I think Dr. King actually supported Zionism. He believed that the Jews should have their own sovereign state and that it should be in Israel. But he was very uncomfortable with the Israeli state's treatment of Palestinians. And he began to speak out in that regard and ask questions. But he believed that there should be a Jewish state. Remember, we got to go back to the core of King. He was a pastor. He believed that there should be an Israel. He believed that the Jewish people deserved a homeland. And so when people look at his quote, each side takes what they want and they run with it. This is what Dr. King said. But he was very troubled by the treatment of the Palestinians and very troubled by Israel's behavior. And we have to draw a distinction here between the Israeli state and the Jewish people, which are a very diverse people, even in Israel at that time. And I think he understood the nuances there. But would he support the current character of the Netanyahu regime? Absolutely not. And he would have been an advocate against it. He might have questioned the standing of the Israeli state as long as there wasn't a Palestinian state. So I think his thinking would have certainly evolved, because time has evolved and the character of that conflict of situation has evolved over time.
Let me also just say that, in fairness, historically to Ralph Bunche, I was just doing some research just in the past 24 hours, and there is evidence that he too would not support the current situation.
I don't think he would. And nobody in the United Nations who works in the ethos of that culture, as I have and many others, would support the current order, because we believe in human rights and we believe in the law of armed conflict and we believe in the responsibility of the state to be a caretaker of the population. And what we've seen globally around the world is unfortunate. Hamas, the Muslim Brotherhood, and the PLO engaged in conduct they never should have engaged in, and so has the Israeli state, so has Lebanon, so has Syria. And so, you know, this is where we are. The one critique I'll give you about Bunche, you know, Bunche came from, I think he started in the OSS, which is the organization that preceded some of our intelligence organizations.
Right.
So there weren't Negroes involved in that world at the time. So Bunche is unique. And I think that there might be a puzzle there that's still not cracked.
And full disclosure, it was the OSS that J. Edgar Hoover was in that came from Marcus Garvey at first. And then that was the precursor to what he formed, the FBI and all of that. So, yeah, but this is the fascination of history, folks. We have the opportunity and the resources today we didn't have before to research these things and find out more, especially what Dr. Levitt has done. Not a lot of time left. Ms. Alberta from Chevy Chase, real, real quick for me, because we got to get ready to go. God bless you, Ms. Alberta. Happy Martin Luther King Day.
Yes, dear, and thanks for you and Dr. Levitt, God, and I hope so much good to you both in the upcoming this year, dear, because there's so much going on. I had to get it out about this man in Israel, Netanyahu. I think he should be removed, but does Dr. Levitt know of any means of how Israel or how the Israeli people overall feel about that man? Do they praise him or do they despise him? Because this man has killed thousands of children and women. And the other one is, how would you grade the continent of Africa? Because I hear good things about what's going on there, but aren't the pyramids still pretty much the rulers of that continent? And the other one, and then I'm going, is about, and how would we grade it at that continent now? That finger went still a 1 to 10. And the other one is about the,
quickly.
The sanctions about what is the United States giving in way of relief funding for Africa? Because people say they're not hardly with Trump, he's not giving them anything. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Alberta. Happy King Day. Three questions, Dr. Levitt.
Okay.
You got three.
I'll do my best. I think Netanyahu is highly unpopular. He never wanted to negotiate for a Palestinian state. I think he's been playing games around this. I think he's a far right-wing leader, and I think Israelis desire something different. And remember, October the 7th happened on his clock, which means there was a failure in their intelligence apparatus. So I think his days are numbered, and he has been indicted before an indictment before the International Criminal Court. So he's going to have to worry about his retirement and where he goes and what he does. So that takes care of Netanyahu. What was the second one? The second one was?
Well, she said grading Africa and all the the colonial powers still having influence.
So, yes, there are large corporations in the metropoles of the colonial states that still have a strong hand in the African continent. Today, I grade Africa's youth, which is the majority. The average age is 18 years old or younger. And the way that they're trying to take the innovation and develop businesses and advance the continent, I give them a 10. I give the leadership a 0. I give the Russian propaganda machine through the Wagner Group, its mercenary company, and its pumping up of Ibrahim Traore and others. I give them a 10 for lying to the world. We don't need military dictators in Africa. What's happening with Russia and China replacing France and the United States and this problem, particularly in Francophone African countries, I think is going to continue to haunt the continent. I think that the Africa's holistic failure to engage the African diaspora. African Americans have boosted the Ghanaian economy by $1 billion, you know, every year, every 2 years, whatever the number is now. African Americans spend $2 trillion a year in consumer spending, which is more than the GDP of the entire sub-Saharan African continent. And yet not one African country has a holistic law of return like Jews have, like Israel has for Jews worldwide. We as Black Americans and diasporans could be the economic and cultural engine to helping transform the African continent. And so when our leaders come here and talk about giving Donald Trump golf courses in their countries and they ingratiate themselves to him, and then he turns around and slaps them with bans so their people can't even come to the country, that is the epitome of white supremacy. I think African nations and their failure to engage us are in a worse position now than 25 to 30 years ago. And until they listen to folks from the diaspora and invoke the policies that will bring us to the continent in meaningful ways, and I'm true citizenship, not what they have in Ghana, a right to abode, not what they have in Benin, which is a transactional kind of tourism scheme that Spike Lee, who's never been to Benin, is pushing. Until they have something meaningful for us, Africa will continue to develop at the pace it's developing, which means that it's going to be behind the rest of the world by 100 years.
Wow. Dr. Jeremy Levitt, Beyond Borders, Martin Luther King Jr., African Pan-Africanism, hot off the presses, brand new. Folks, you can watch this interview after the fact on social media. It'll be shared. Doctor, what you've done is so, so valuable. I'm already getting text messages from other scholars and other folks in the movement. The embrace of Kemet, the possibility of Dr. King, or having been chosen to be a mediator in the Biafran a crisis, the American Negro Leadership Conference on Africa. Y'all, this is before Trans-African, OAU and everything. So all of these things were going on. He did not just give one speech. He did not just operate in one city.
That's right.
And we're thankful to 89.3 MIP on 89.3 WPFW, Katia Stitt, and our program director and all for helping encouraging us to have this discussion in this hour. My brother, congratulations to you. Listen, man, if you don't do nothing else, you have done something so valuable with this book.
Appreciate it.
And I'm not really supposed to encourage stuff on the air, but in my scholarship, I'm going to encourage this book and make it mandatory for everybody I run into. Let's get this better perspective. Dr. Jeremy Levitt, he's also that way on Instagram. And again, the book is available. So enlighten yourselves, sisters and brothers, ladies and gentlemen. Dr. Levitt, thank you so much. And we will talk again, okay?
I appreciate it, brother. Thank you for all that you do to advance our people at a time when they're under the attack that we're under, not just in this country, but globally. We got to be the light in the darkness. So I appreciate everything you're doing.
Bless you, doctor. If all hearts and minds, first of all, happy Martin Luther King Jr. Day, folks. Say it out loud. Like
yeah.
When you land in Baltimore, say Thurgood Marshall Airport. Don't say BWI. When you fly to Birmingham, say Fred Shuttlesworth Airport. Don't say Birmingham Airport. Call the names that we fought to have on these edifices and on these holidays. Happy Martin Luther King.
Say edifices again. I like the way you say it again, brother. Edifices.
Edifices.
Yes.
Yes. Happy Martin Luther King Jr. Day. One and all.
Thanks for getting woke and listening to Make It Plain. As always, perform an act of kindness on behalf of an elder or young person. Write a letter to a sister or brother who just so happens to find her or himself incarcerated. Offer libations to the ancestors upon whose sturdy shoulders we all now stand. And above all, give thanks to the God of your understanding by whatever name you call her and him. All God asks of us is that we give each other love. Thanks for giving MIP love. And please remember to subscribe and give us a 5-star rating. If all hearts and minds are clear, it has been made plain.